Good evening to you. It's my pleasure to welcome you on behalf of the Chapter of Westminster Abbey to this, the second dialogue in the Institute's autumn series on art, imagination and public service. My name is Paul Bowman. I'm Receiver General here, and in that capacity I lead the lay administration of the Abbey. More relevantly for tonight, I also chair the Institute, which is the organising group for this particular set of lectures. As many of you will know, the Institute was founded in 2013 with a remit to nurture moral and spiritual values in public life and service. And as well as these biannual lecture series, we also run a very active fellows program for aspiring public service leaders and also occasional private seminars for government departments and other organizations seeking a safe space to explore challenging issues through the lens of moral values. In previous years, the lectures have tackled topics ranging from justice and democracy to integrity and truth. But in this series of dialogues, we're trying something a bit different. By bringing public servants of various types into conversation with artists, poets, and musicians, we're aiming to stimulate an imaginative cross-fertilization of ideas with valuable insights flowing in both directions. As a former bureaucrat and lifelong musician, I'm particularly looking forward to this evening's event, which focuses on the parallels between public service in its various forms and the process of musical creation. And as if that were not exciting enough in itself, the themes emerging from this evening's exploration will be illuminated by live performance, as far as I know, for the first time in the history of the Institute. So we may or may not convince you that bureaucracy can be made beautiful, as the title of this dialogue rather optimistically suggests, but either way, I hope you're in for an inspiring evening. And on the theme of beauty, I should perhaps say something about the wonderful setting for this dialogue. The Lady Chapel of the Abbey is an undoubted masterpiece of late medieval architecture. It dates from 1516 and was built on the instructions of Henry VII, whose elaborate tomb you see just behind the altar. Its greatest treasure, though, is, of course, the spectacular fan-vaulted ceiling, made all the more miraculous, I would say, by the fact that it's only 5 centimetres thick. But you don't need to worry, it's been there for several hundred years and is probably going to stay there for a bit longer. So it's an ideal location for tonight's dialogue, also as it has a fine acoustic for music, slightly more challenging for speech, I have to say, and is a working chapel dedicated to the outstanding public servants honoured by membership of the Order of the Bath, one of whom is our chair this evening. If you take a look at Claire Moriarty's biography, which is on your seats, you'll see that she doesn't shy away from challenging tasks. In the past, she's tackled the NHS, I know a bit about that, the railway system and the common agricultural policy, and she's recently taken on the seemingly impossible task of bringing harmony to the cross-governmental delivery of Brexit, whatever I have to say, Claire, that ends up meaning. You'll also notice that she's a choral singer, which makes her ideally equipped to debate tonight's topic with James O'Donnell, whom she will introduce shortly. Finally, before I shut up, there are just a couple of practicalities I need to mention. Please do silence any electronic equipment that is not altogether medically necessary. And we'd be very, very grateful if you could refrain from taking photographs or making recordings while the dialogue is taking place. There will be an opportunity for questions to our speakers later on. I'd ask you to wait for the arrival of a microphone before introducing yourself and asking your question. Enough of all of that. I do hope that you enjoy what will be a very stimulating evening. And now I hand over to you, Claire, for getting things underway. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Paul, for that lovely introduction. It's a real pleasure for me to be here today. I've been a civil servant for over a third of a century, and increasingly I've been interested in how we lead the civil service and how we create an environment where people can grow and flourish. I've been a singer even longer, and in my early days as a civil servant I helped set up the Elysian Singers, who we're going to hear from this evening. And in recent years, I've benefited from what the Westminster Abbey Institute has offered in terms of particularly a safe space to bring people to have a different type of conversation. And in turn, I've been able to give back a little as a member of the Institute's Council of Reference. So today kind of brings all of that together. Here we are, as Paul was saying, in the Lady Chapel of Westminster Abbey, the home place of the Order of the Bath, which celebrates public service. Talking to James O'Donnell, the organist and master of the choristers here at Westminster Abbey, a really superb musician with a huge breadth of experience across a range of areas which we will explore. And we're here to have a conversation about the parallels between making music and making policy, about leadership in our respective domains, about how the public good is served through both music and the civil service. So a little word about how today's dialogue is going to run. When I was trying to think about this dialogue, I reacted as a good civil servant would, and as you will know, some of you in the audience who are civil servants. So I reached for a framework. We like a framework. And thinking about the leadership roles I've had in over my time in the civil service, I kind of pulled out three things which they have in common. All of them, broadly speaking, were about getting things done. They were all about making things happen through people, and they were all about connecting with the world outside. Nothing that we do as the civil service, whether we're making policy or delivering services to people, has any validity really unless we're connecting with the outside world. And there are parallels for each of these in music. So there's a parallel for getting things done in interpreting music. There's a parallel for making it happen through people, turning the notes into performance via a group of musicians. And there's a parallel with connecting with the world outside in the effect that music can have on the audience. So I think the framework could apply. There's a good question about whether or not it's the framework that a musician would choose to represent their world, and that's something that we will come back to. But I'm going to start by talking to James about each of those sides of the triangle, and then at the end of each of those kind of triangle side discussions, we're going to have a piece of related choral music sung by the Elysian Singers, who are they're tucked away at the side at the moment, but they will emerge to sing. The Elysians, I'm very proud to be a member of the Elysian Singers, which is one of the finest chamber choirs in London and has a very broad repertoire, some of which you will get to experience this evening. And then we'll gather the threads, having talked about the three sides of the triangle, we'll gather the threads together and open the discussion out more broadly to all of you in the room. So, James, it's lovely to be having this conversation. We've had a few kind of preliminary conversations, but we've tried to make sure that we haven't covered too much of the ground so that we will have new things to explore. So I wanted to start with this question about getting stuff done. And my policy analogy is, you know, when we're making policy, in very broad terms, we start with the overall direction that we want to take. Then we break it down into chunks. We work through a lot of detail. We usually have to do some very complex negotiation with our colleagues. And then finally, you know, we put it out to the world. We publish the document. And I suppose my first question to you is, how does that work? Is there a similar process when you're thinking about music?
I think so, and obviously it's not the same as running a government department, or it's a specific kind of field. But the getting the stuff done can, of course, work on several levels. So if you're a composer and somebody has commissioned you to write a piece, then you have to give an awful lot of thought to what that might be. I mean, sometimes there's quite a specific brief. Often composers are very pleased to have a specific brief, because otherwise they're left with a blank sheet of paper and a bit of a blank brain and time pressure. So a specific brief can really narrow down a range of options in quite a creative way. So far from being restrictive, quite a lot of composers that I have worked with, I'm not a composer in any meaningful sense of that word, but quite a lot of the composers I have worked with have actually said, please could you give me a little bit more of a steer on what you actually want. So the getting the stuff done can start on that kind of level, and then there's the actual delivery of it, and again, people work in their own different ways. I mean, in the arts, there isn't a prescribed way of doing something, and one of the great things about being in the arts is the fact that there isn't a prescribed way of doing something. And somebody can be taught. For example, the great sort of the French academic painters were terribly restrictive at some point when they said this is the only way you can paint a picture, and that person didn't paint like that, so he is out of the scheme of consideration. He's anathema, and he isn't obeying the rules. And there are all kinds of musical equivalents of that at various points in history. But now I think we're in a very eclectic world where the stuff is almost anything that anybody decides that they would like it to be. So from the compositional point of view, enormous variety. From the performing point of view, there is a huge level of debate about how you actually go about performing music. What it is to perform a music. Is a piece of music a piece of music until it's performed? Is it fully a piece of music? I can give you a copy of the score of a Beethoven symphony. In what sense is that copy a piece of music? Until it's played. And there's a sort of philosophical question about the actuation of what the stuff actually is. But the performance of it and how to go about preparing a performance, again, there's a huge variety of approaches. One of the interesting things recently has been the debate, and when I say recently, in the last few decades, has been the growing debate about historically informed performance and what that means. And at various early stages of this, I think we've sort of come through this now, but not so long ago, there were people who thought that the text of the music, the sort of the stuff of the music, as it were, was in itself an inviolable sort of authoritative thing that was almost fetishized. You couldn't depart from the text at all. You couldn't play your instrument in a way that hadn't been set down in a treatise by an 18th century flautist or an early 19th century cellist or something like that. You had to do exactly the permission to perform and to come at the material came from other people's thinking. And it rather took away the individual's approach, the individual musician's approach to the music. And you're actually doing something that somebody else has programmed you to do, or you have informed yourself in a variety of ways about the programs that are there and sort of selected them without thinking that you're doing that, because if you read something you don't like about how to perform a piece of music, for example, you might perhaps look for another treatise which says something a bit more to your taste. So there are all kinds of layers of this kind of coming at things.
And just thinking about in that world where music becomes quite inviolable, how do you get evolution? Because in the same way, in the policy space, sometimes you get a very gradual evolution where things build on other things, and then sometimes you get a big break and a kind of radical new departure. How does that work in music?
There are equivalents. I mean, there are people who have suddenly presented the world, the musical world, with an extremely new approach to something, often something old. For example, the way we sing. Again, there are schools of singing, and sometimes they can be quite prescriptive of the sound you make. I'm always interested when I go to Germany and I hear a choir in Germany. I can always tell it's a German choir just by like the style of singing. There's a sort of way that they sing, and I've spoken to German choir masters about this. There's a way that you approach it. But sometimes people will say, well, this is my vision for how I want this music to sound. And it can be quite shocking. I remember the first time I ever heard a countertenor. That took me a while to get over that one. And there are some singers who, again, specialise in early music, who sang in a very kind of unusual way, without any vibrato, almost in a provocative way. This is different music, and it doesn't come from a kind of an evolved, developed accrual of performance practices and traditions. It's something that I've rethought and completely sort of reinvented. And the basis for that could be something historic, it could be some research, It could be based on a variety of different sources, or it could be based on personal creative imagination.
Great, and I think that's a lovely moment to have our first piece of music. The pieces that we are hearing today have been chosen by Sam Lawton, the director of the Elysians, to reflect the sides of the triangle that we're talking about. And I think there's an obvious connection with what James has just been saying. So the first piece is Judith Weir's "Love Bade Me Welcome." And Sam's described this as a composer getting stuff done by writing very precisely to her brief, taking a famous poem already full of religious allegory and adding just enough music to bring it further to life without overburdening it. So we'll hear from the choir. Thank you very much indeed for that. So the second side of the triangle is about building the team, making it happen through people. And I'm particularly interested in what happens when we're working through people where we don't have a shared background, where we couldn't do their job. And I'm thinking back to a time when I took over responsibility for rail. Well, I knew very little about rail, and I suddenly found myself in charge of a team of rail experts and commercial specialists where there was absolutely no way that I could take over and do their job, even if I'd wanted to. And it really made me think about what was the way in which I could add value to what other people were doing. And it strikes me there's possibly an analogy with a conductor of a big orchestra, where maybe there are some people who can play every instrument in the orchestra, but I suspect not many. And how, as a conductor, you can really bring people together and add that value and get people to respect what you're bringing to the process.
That's a very interesting question, because again, it works on a lot of different levels. I mean, there are quite a lot of musicians who couldn't possibly tell you what a conductor's for. They think that's a complete waste of space. There's a very funny story of the chap arriving late for a leader of an orchestra arriving late for a rehearsal in some town. He said, "I'm terribly sorry, I was leading a concert for Sir Somebody at Birmingham, and there was bad traffic." He said, "Oh, yes." And he didn't mention the name, that's what he said. I was leading a concert of the Brahms Requiem, and somebody said, "Oh, who was conducting?" He said, "I don't know, I never looked." So, sorry, I ruined my own story. There we are. But there we are. It doesn't stop it being good or true. But what are you trying to do as a conductor? I mean, that's a terribly difficult question to answer, because at any given moment of a piece, you're trying to do something else. And at any given moment of a rehearsal, or a rehearsal process, or a planning process, you're trying to do something different. So quite a lot of the time, you don't consciously think about what you're doing. And I suspect that is quite a difference between doing a sort of more administrative job where there is an absolutely kind of clear agenda. Whereas, you see, when you're conducting, let's say, a Beethoven symphony, to take something that isn't in my personal sort of orbit of music, there isn't a clear agenda. I mean, there are the notes and there is the orchestra, but the agenda is whatever you think it needs to be, and nobody says you've got to do it like that or like this. The players will play in the way that they think it should go, or the way that they're used to playing, or in a sort of safe general purpose kind of way, until they get some signals to disabuse them of that. So the kind of signals a conductor gives are, I mean, people say it's all about conducting technique, and it is partly about that. The sorts of signals a conductor gives are personality signals, often. And they're not verbal. It's not about what you say in a rehearsal. Some very, very eminent and wonderful conductors hardly said anything in a rehearsal at all, and hardly conducted, really. It was about, it's about something in the middle, which is almost indefinable. So, of course, you can study the skill and the craft of conducting, and you do need to know how to communicate these things. But actually, the communication is on a very, very difficult to describe level, I think. And you have to, sorry, to go to the other point you said about being faced with a lot of people. Of course, very few conductors can play all the instruments, but actually quite a lot of conductors can't play any of them at all. And so what are they doing? That you can't say, would you please play like that? Would you please play? You have to give more of a sense of context and more of a sense of everybody coming together and doing things that fit in to a shape. And again, it's a moulding thing. It's a constantly changing organic process. It's very difficult to define. And the other thing is, if you conduct a piece, let's say you conduct Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, to just make a crass example, when you're a 20-year-old at university with your college orchestra, could be quite good in many ways. When 10 years later you'll conduct it with a different kind of orchestra, you have done 10 years of music between that performance, the first one, and 10 years of study and 10 years of being more mature and growing up as a musician. What you do in 10 years' time, or 5 years, or whatever it is, after the first time, is going to be totally different, and similarly again and again and again. So going back to the same point, you're not going to be the same person. Your leadership will be different, and your interaction will be different. So it's a very complicated.
Yeah, and that's a really interesting point. One of the other thing I just want to explore briefly is the difference between what's often, and a lot of the musical employment world is quite transient. You're booked to do a particular series of concerts, and then you stop doing that. What you have in the Abbey with the choir is a much longer term relationship, where I imagine the way in which as the master of the choristers, you interact with the choir is rather different from the experience of many conductors.
Yes, I think that's true, and there's a great excitement to be had in a sort of what you call a scratch orchestra or a scratch choir, getting somebody together on an ad hoc basis, and everybody has to sort of gel together quickly. There's this sort of discovery of new dynamics or adverting to new dynamics and sort of trying to capture something of a working operational dynamic in a room. The conductor can be very useful. The role of the conductor there can be very decisive, because people need to be kind of on with their antennae on full twitch. In a longer term relationship, in a context like this, or something like an orchestra where the same conductor, I'm thinking of Halle, for example, with Sir Mark Elder, or Birmingham with Simon Rattle some years ago, very long-term relationship where there's a deepening from day to day and a continuity it's a different kind of dynamic. Both are very valid, I think, and both are very exciting, and it's quite good to try to get a little bit of each into both, I think, somehow.
And do you feel you have a responsibility for people's kind of long-term musical development in a choir?
Well, certainly, when I'm here training the boys, there's a very, very fast track musical training here. It's not just about, in my view, it's not just about choral training and vocal training. That's the ostensible surface of it. It's really about training musicians, and to be a good musician in an ensemble, you have to learn how to be a person in a setting with other people. You have to be sensitive enough to breathe with them and predict what they're going to do. It's like playing in a football team or being in a kind of very complicated social environment. It's very, very much more than just about musical skill. So there is the training. One is training the boys here. From the point of view of the professional musicians, I take the responsibility of an employer and a director of music. I'm not the employer, of course. I'm just a director of music. But I take the responsibility of training and nurturing very carefully, very, very seriously. So I'm very, very keen that people look after their voices, they keep doing things that are interesting and bring them further along, help the development of their musicality and their career. And so I think all of these things go into the mix.
Lovely. So I think we'll hear from the choir again. I'm just struck by the analogies there with leading any group of people, where it is very much about the whole. It's the whole person, and we spend lots of time, particularly trying to think about well-being and the broader context. So getting away from you just come to work to do something, but actually, how do we grow and nurture people with lots of similarities. So the next piece we're going to hear is Antonio Lotti's Crucifixus. At 8. A classic example of building a team in sound by gradually adding each of eight parts in turn, each one adding a slightly different perspective to the existing sound. A piece perfectly designed for the acoustics of this wonderful chapel. That was absolutely fantastic. Thank you. So moving on to the third side of the triangle, which is about connecting with the audience. As I said at the beginning, most of public policy only really exists when it comes into contact with people. You can do things in the abstract, but they don't really have meaning. And I'm interested again in the parallels. How important is it when you think about music to be thinking about the way it lands with the people who are listening to it?
Well, that's again it's very difficult to answer that question, because I suspect if you play, I seem to be on a Beethoven roll at the moment, play a Beethoven piano sonata to an audience of 100 people, there are 100 different ways of listening to it, even to the one way of playing it that you're experiencing. So it's difficult, you can't really second guess how people are going to receive a piece of music. And you shouldn't try. So the job of the performer, it seems to me, is to try to work out how one is going to approach a given piece of music, how one is going to play it or sing it or conduct it or whatever, and then try to do that as well as possible, and to think out a coherent musical approach. So when I said a few moments ago that there was no agenda when you have a score of a Beethoven symphony, well, of course, the agenda is to perform it well. Sorry. So you can decide there are many different ways of doing it, is what I meant. And it's the same thing, that you can't play for an audience in a way that you think that audience might like. There's an interesting point about competitions, for example. Occasionally, these music competitions, piano competitions or violin competitions, some people say that there are certain ways that the juries of certain competitions like to hear the music played, or certain things that they like and certain things that they don't like. And there's a sort of sport that you can sort of get into if you really want to, which is to try to play in a way that's going to impress a particular kind of jury. I really find that all very difficult to understand, because I think the only person as a musician that ultimately you have to satisfy in the music making is yourself. And the whole point about learning to be a musician, studying to be a musician, spending your life doing that and deepening your competence and your knowledge and your maturity and your experience, is to improve your own self-awareness as a musician, your own self-critical faculties. That sounds awfully kind of self-involved and rather kind of dismissive of the audience, but actually it's like saying something aloud. You think something and then you express it aloud. It's that kind of leap that you make when you say it aloud that is the equivalent of playing to an audience or singing to an audience.
And do you think if you took a piece of music and you only ever performed it in a closed room, would that make any difference? Would it matter to the value of the music?
It wouldn't matter to the value of the music, but if music is about communication, there would be, a question if you only ever did that. Who are you communicating the music to? And there's a great satisfaction to playing music for one's own satisfaction, and that's fine, but it seems to me that to actuate the music, if that's even a word, I don't even know, somebody will tell me, to make it a real thing, there's a part of a triangle of interpretation. The composers composed the music, the performers performed it, and the listeners received it. And if there's never that third bit, there could be said to be something missing. But it's a very interesting concept. Of course, most musicians spend the vast majority of their time playing themselves. I mean, a concert pianist will spend 95% of his or her life in a studio practicing on their own, and only the other 5% or 10% or what have you in front of an audience. So you do spend an awful lot of time on it yourself, so it has value, of course.
Yes, but when you're practicing, it's an interesting question of what's the value of rehearsal versus the value of performance. So when you're practicing, are you practicing in order to be able to perform, or are you practicing to become better at what you're playing?
Again, that's a very hard question to answer. I think it's a bit of both, and it depends on when your next performance might be. But it does strike me that practice is about habit, and if you're, for example, an athlete, you can't say, well, I've got a competition coming up, so I better start, 2 weeks beforehand, I better start doing some running or something, because you're probably doing it all the time, because it's what you do. It's part of your, it's like breathing or getting up in the morning or having a shower. It's part of who you are. It's part of your life, and it's part of your habit. So I think, for me, I can only speak for myself. I find practicing really satisfying as a way of kind of discovering who I am as a musician. Unfortunately, when you're a professional musician and you have engagements in your diary, the agenda for preparation does take over a lot. But there's no reason why they shouldn't actually coexist very positively, I think. But the proportion of which is dominant will vary, I think.
Mm. And do you think it matters who music is performed to?
You mean as in different sorts of audiences?
Yes, but yeah. I mean, I'm conscious that the audience for some types of music is quite narrow, and so there's quite an interesting question of whether we should be adjusting the music to suit the audience or try to educate a wider range of people to be interested in different types of music.
Yeah, that's a really difficult thing, because ultimately, very full of difficult questions. I suppose, one could look at, let's say, organ music. Now, that's a little bit of a niche interest. But it's so funny because it can be quite challenging to attract large audiences to come and hear organ music in some circumstances. And in other circumstances, you have to close the doors half an hour before the concert because the place is dangerously full. I mean, if you go to Cologne Cathedral, for example, there will be 3,000 people sitting there in silence 20 minutes before the concert begins. And you look and you think, this is extraordinary. And then in this country, you sort of have to press gang people in through the door to make them come. So I don't know why. I don't know why that is. But there is an art to programming and trying to present music for what you identify as your public. And there's a very good idea of actually a very good sense in trying to get a new public along, but it's quite difficult to do all these things all at once. But I whether you would perform the music, the same music, differently for a different audience, I think is doubtful, because how would you work out how you were going to perform for a different audience?
Yeah,
you might perform different music, but you'd have to do it in a, I think you'd have to do it in the way that you felt it had to be done. But that could partly depend on the context in which you were doing it. Again, you might not even be aware of that. You might just pick up a vibe and, I don't know.
Yeah. Okay, so I think this is a nice moment for our third piece of music, which I think is somebody who's pretty good at, for a composer who's good at picking up vibes. So this is Lux Aurumque by Eric Whittaker. And Eric Whittaker is someone who's made his career by connecting with the audience, both creating an immediate and attention-grabbing sound world, but also by his use of the internet and his profile to draw singers and listeners together. So I think that's a good example of that last point. Thank you again, and we'll be hearing, we have one last moment from the Elysians at the end. But we've been on a journey around the three sides of the civil servants triangle. We've talked about getting stuff done, we've talked about making it happen through people, and we've talked about connecting with the audience. So I think we've established that the three elements of the civil servants triangle do have parallels in the musical world, but there's a question about whether they make a good musician's triangle, or whether, if you think about the most important elements of the musical life, it would be a slightly different selection.
Yes. I would suggest that there isn't a triangle in a musician's life.
No triangles.
It's more like a kind of circle, and you keep working out where you are on it and finding out that it's a bigger circle than you thought it was. It's very tricky. But, I mean, one of the... I think being a musician isn't about just doing music. I think it is about being a musician. It's a being rather than a doing thing. That doesn't sound too sort of highfalutin. Because, I mean, actually, there's an imperative to making music for a musician, or I think there should be, and it's something that you shouldn't be able to not do, ideally. So, at various stages of my career, I've thought, not recently, of course, but I've occasionally thought, well, should I really be doing this, and should perhaps I should do something else? And then I come back to the conclusion, the inescapable conclusion, that I have to do it, and that I couldn't really do anything else, and not because I couldn't, but because I personally couldn't do that. It's so allied with my, or aligned with how I am. So I feel very much that there is a sort of, there's almost a vocational element to being a musician. Now, there is a vocational element in public service, I know that, in many other professions. But it's something that I think goes really very, very deep for a musician. So trying to kind of say, well, these are the things that we do, there are so many things, and that some of them are very difficult to put a name to, I think. And the great thing is you keep discovering whole worlds of doing different things, or you come across somebody who's playing a piece differently, or conducting a piece differently, or you hear it in a different way, you receive it differently, or you heard various other pieces of music since you played or heard another piece, and you then hear that piece that you originally heard in a different light, and you're constantly changing the whole time. And I think that's why it's very difficult to pin this down from a musician's point of view.
So that's really interesting, and I'm going to open it up in a moment so we can sort of broaden the dialogue out. But, I mean, the exam question for these three dialogues was, would greater dialogue with arts, in this case music, help policymakers? So I'm going to ask you that question, but with a slight rider, because I think what you've said about music being about being rather than doing is really important. And I mean, I suspect there's many, many of us in the room who are, for whom music is important, that's why we've chosen to come along today, as well as doing other things. So those of us for whom it's part of our lives, but not our professional lives. And so I guess sort of part A of the question is, which I think I can guess the answer to, is would greater dialogue with music help policymakers? And I suppose part two is, how can policymakers who are interested in music find a better connection with that musical side of ourselves? How can we bring that that sense of kind of being into our working lives?
Is that it?
You want more?
Okay. No, I'll try. I can't answer the fact. I can't answer whether policymakers would find music interesting. But I do think, and just to answer the question slightly more generally, I went to a very interesting conference, and there was a discussion of what music is actually, and it was in context of sacred music. But I think it applies generally to the arts and also to music. And there's a sort of incarnational aspect to music. And I think what the music's sort of there, and people sort of catch it. So the composer, the music's there, the composer sort of brings it into a realization, joining something that's sort of out there somehow, and the performer joins that. So there's a deeply creative and profoundly creative aspect of music, and I think that I dare say I can only speculate on this from my own point of view, but I would think that in terms of making policies that deeply affect people, that does apply on a quite a serious level. And that it isn't about just coming up with, of course, it isn't just about coming up with good policies that make sense and and tick along, but it's something, there's a deeper connection to what policies do, and I think there's a deeper connection to what music is than just the sound it makes. So on that level, I think that there could be some profoundly interesting thinking to do.
Mm. And very relevant to the idea of public good. So this is not just, as you say, it's a deeper connection. It's not just the thing. It's what sits underneath it.
Yeah.
So, I mean, let me at that point throw that question open. So feel free to ask questions if you want to, but also, I mean, I'm sure James is as well, just interested to get views from people here about what does that say to you? What does it say to us about what we might do that's different from where we are at the moment? So one down here, if we can get a mic.
Thank you. My name is Emily Miles. I work at the Food Standards Agency. I thought that was fascinating, and the music was beautiful as well. Thank you very, very much. One of the things I sing, and I used to play the oboe, and I did music A-level, and one of the things that music does for me is create delight and wonder. And it's one of the things I've been wondering as a public policy maker and civil servant whether we need to be doing more of, thinking about delight and wonder. There have been moments in my career when I have tangibly felt the difference that I've made as a civil servant to real people's lives, whether it's giving asylum seekers status in the country, or I mean, even this weekend, thinking about the Environment Agency doing flood warnings and trying to stop people from having their homes flooded. And I think there's, I suppose it's a question for Claire, really. Has delight and wonder ever featured much in your thinking about your policy making?
I think I might refer back to the point that Paul made at the end about having taken on some interestingly challenging roles. I think, I mean, yes, it kind of has to, because if we don't find some delight and wonder in what we do, then there is nothing to get out of bed in the morning for. And when one of the things that interests me most about public service is we get out of bed in the morning to make the world a better place. And making the world a better place has to involve, trying to elements of delight. If I actually kind of run the Rolodex through the things that many of my jobs have been about fixing things. So I think, you know, we all spend lots of time, making services better. I spent some time working on prevention of drug misuse. I spent a lot of time trying to make the health service work in the best possible way. So they're all things which feel very important. I'm kind of struggling to think of the example, I would say, and that one was absolutely about delight. And that maybe is what we know. And when James was talking about things being deeply creative, you know, immediately there's something in me that responds to that. But it's quite, I think when I think about an organisation and how I can create a feeling in an organisation, that's when it's more easy to find delight, because what's much of the content of what we do is about fixing things rather than creating delight. Stephen.
Hello, I'm Stephen Jones. I'm not currently in public service, but I was a senior manager in the NHS. And my question is for James. In the NHS, we spent a lot of time shaping our delivery with the public, with our audience. And in the way you were describing it, I wasn't clear quite what role does the audience have, perhaps not within a performance, but between performances, how you look at the response from the audience in shaping your growth as a musician?
Yes, and I'm aware that I might have underplayed the role of the audience in my comments, which was not deliberate. If I were to... I think anybody who's performed a piece of music in front of an audience or with an audience gets a lot of... gets a huge amount of energy from the audience. It's a dynamic relationship. I think listening is a deeply active thing. I think it isn't passive to sit there in a concert hall or in an evensong, even listening to the choirs. sections of the service. And I think that there's been some sort of thinking which is unhelpful over past decades about that in the Catholic Church, particularly, that people are beginning now to sort of rethink. So the dynamic relationship between the audience and the performers is, I think, a really important one. That's not to say that there has to be an audience present for the music to be created. I think one of the most inspiring things about actually being here, we're very lucky here, is that when we sing Evensong from day to day, there is a large audience, in the literal sense of that word, congregation, to receive the music that the choir is giving. And I think that our knowledge that there are so many people there who are paying attention to the music is very inspiring, and it's a very good thing to be aware of. And it can be quite demoralizing if you have prepared, let's say, go back to organ recitals, which is an obvious example. If you prepared an organ recital for months and months and months and worked hard on something, and then about 3 dozen people come, if you're lucky, I mean, it's fine that they're there, but it does feel sort of the energy, something about the potential energy could be a bit lacking. So I think the audience is very important, and the knowledge that there will be one is important. So when you are preparing for a performance in public, you don't want to let down the people who've come, who've taken an evening out of their schedule and stumped up whatever amount of money it costs them for the ticket to come and to experience something. You want to play your part in their experience. So I think it is a very important dynamic relationship.
I'm going to take a few comments. So there's 2 people next to each other there and 1 just in front. So let's do those 3 and then we'll go over the other side.
Perfect, thank you. Hi, so I'm Sophie Danreiter and I work at the Cabinet Office at the moment. I've got a question, I think, for Claire, but sparked by something that you'd said, James, around how in music you have sort of schools of doing things and kind of very specific rules in certain periods of time where you are sort of limited or filtered in what you can do. And that's something I remember very strongly from playing a lot of music at school, where I was taught to sing in a certain way or listening to Suzuki tapes of exactly how you should play the violin or the viola. And it's something that I find in the civil service as well, perhaps a little too strongly, where there are these sort of ways of doing things or there is a filter, or it kind of becomes more about the process than actually what we're trying to solve or which lives we're trying to improve. And I wondered, Claire, what your thoughts are on what we as civil servants can do to kind of push through all that and think even more about what it is that we are trying to achieve and what changes we want to make and almost kind of see through best practice or submission formulas and those sorts of things.
Okay, thank you.
Hello, I'm Edward Orlick. I'm a civil servant in the Cabinet Office as well. I've been the public servant for 4 years now. Had I been learning the violin for 4 years, I'm sure there's no way that James would let me anywhere near an orchestra that he has anything to do with. But I do have a role in public service. And I wondered, Claire, what you thought the qualities that made a public servant orchestra ready would be.
And there's the lady diagonally in front, yeah.
My name's Adela Gooch, and I worked for Walton Park, the Foreign Office Discussion Centre. But I wanted to slightly pick up on something you said, James. We are here in a place of worship. That is primarily what it's for. Therefore, what you do is for the greater glory of God. Now, if there is an audience there that participates and is somehow raised to a spiritual level through that, that is the purpose, but I don't think it's a performance.
No, I disagree with that. I think it is a performance of music. That's what we do as musicians. But I don't think it means what you suggest that it means, because performances can be for the glory of God. Why can't they be? A musician is... I mean, when the choir sings a piece of music in Evensong, we're performing the piece of music in Evensong. That's what we're doing. We're not performing it. So there's no pejorative concept of performance in my view. Sometimes people do use that pejoratively in the context of sacred music. But as I say, I don't agree with that. I quite agree with you that what we do is for the glory of God. But to train a musician, to take part in a musical, a performance of a musical work in the context of worship is, I think, deeply glorifying and uplifting for people. So I think the two things live together, in my view.
Let me try and pick up the other two questions. The first one about what is it, how do we break out of tram lines, in a sense? I think a lot of it is just deciding that we can. There are some things which we need to do to a high standard of rigour, because we do, you know, the part of the thing about being a public servant is that we're held to account and we have to be able to justify the decisions that we make. And so there are some things where I would defend to the hilt the necessity to do things right. There are an awful lot of other things which we do in the same way because that's what we're used to. And almost all of those, my slightly heretical view on this is they can be deconstructed and we can do them another way. That's about courage, and it's about giving space and recognising that the ideas, on the whole, don't come from the top, where things we tend to kind of, you know, we're a bit fossilised in how things were a long time ago. But, you know, which is why I quite often describe the most useful thing I do is nurturing rebels, providing space for people to do different things, both, you know, shining a light on it, saying, look, isn't that interesting what's happening over there? And also providing a bit of protection when, as inevitably, when you start doing things differently, the odd thing goes wrong. And just being there to pick up, to sort of go, no, it's okay. The fact that one thing's gone wrong over here doesn't mean that we can never try an experiment again. And I do think that is the job of senior leaders, but it's a slightly one end of the spectrum, shall we say. And in terms of what makes a public servant orchestra ready, I think that's a really interesting question. I think in reality, people join different types of orchestras at different stages of their careers. James was talking about, you know, the 20-year-old conducting the college orchestra, some of us played squeaky violins in infant school orchestras that made awful, awful noises because no one could ever tune the violins properly. So there's a kind of, it's not so much what makes us orchestra ready, it's how do we keep refining the skills that mean that we can play in the best possible orchestra for the level of skill that we're able to develop. And I think that's something, public service has less of a cut-off that says, you know, you have to be incredibly good even to be able to start doing this professionally. You know, we come in and we do things and we learn and we grow, and it is more of a kind of a path that you find your way along. Okay, let's take a few points from there, the other side of the room, and then we will need to wrap up. So I think I can see certainly three hands and one at the back. So if we gather up those.
My name's Maria. I'm from DFID. Thank you very much. That's the Department for International Development. I should spell that out. I noticed a tension potentially between the role of intuition and kind of control, and I felt, James, you were resisting frameworks because you wanted to leave more space for organic intuition. But I guess in music there are a range of frameworks, for example, the actual written music, or even in jazz you'd have some sort of framework. But I wondered what advice you might give about holding those things in tension to the civil service, and Claire, what your experience of the role of intuition is, particularly in leading across a kind of wide network with lots of different perspectives. Hope that makes sense.
Yep, great. Do you want to pass back?
Thank you. Morwenna Carrington, Department of Health and Social Care. I was struck particularly by what James was talking about, the importance of unspoken communication as the conductor of an orchestra. And playing in an orchestra, I can remember how the sort of sublime feeling of that sort of unspoken communication. As civil servants, though, we spend an awfully long time trying to choose the right words and crafting the right sentences. So this is a question for Claire, really. To what extent is
being an authentic leader more than just the words you say, and it's something more indefinable about who you are.
Great, thank you. And then if you can, there's two hands at the back, and then we will have to draw a line.
Thank you. I'm Adam Bayliss-West, and I work at the Home Office. I suppose I'm going to do another very civil servant-ish thing and sort of take us back to the commission or the brief or the exam question, and this idea that bureaucracy should be beautiful. And I suppose there are lots of ways in which bureaucracy can be metaphorically beautiful and change people's lives and improve the world for the better. But the question in my mind is, do we really mean that in the sort of core sense of beauty as something which is aesthetically pleasing to the senses or to the mind? And do you have any thoughts on the extent to which producing websites or briefs or buildings that are beautiful can positively influence the way that we experience a bureaucracy and the way in which we interact with one another and the way in which we do our work?
Right. And then lastly at the back. That was a repeat vote, was it?
Yes.
Okay. So let me have a go at intuition and authenticity. I might then get James to have a first go at beauty, because it's a really, really difficult question, and I'm asking the difficult questions, not answering them. So intuition. So I'm personally a great believer in intuition, on the basis that it is mostly, it's a shortcut process going in your brain about things which you could logically argue your way to. There's a Malcolm Gladwell book, I think, about intuition. And the thing that reassured me is that it's not that it's a completely alien process set apart from logic, because civil servants, of course, we're very attached to logic. But it is sometimes you can do it more quickly than you can work it out, and then you can go back and find the stages afterwards. And I can vividly remember as a very junior civil servant realising that I could sometimes read something and know there was a gap in the argument, and it took me some time to find what the gap was, but I could see there was a gap. And that was quite a useful kind of technical skill. And then as I got more experienced, and I realised I could kind of do the same thing with people, so I could have a conversation with people, and I could kind of feel if, you know, I mean, I talk about it as a kind of dissonance meter. So if what they were saying wasn't quite working with what I was hearing, then actually that told me something about where they were and whether they felt uncomfortable, and it just formed a starting point for kind of teasing things out. So I think we tend, because we are very attached to logic and reasoning and, you know, being able to be accountable for things, I think we tend to underplay the value of intuition, but it is hugely valuable. And partly, to go on to the awareness point about authenticity, it's partly for exactly that reason, because actually it is, you know, that the intuition shortcut helps to see when things are and aren't authentic, because authenticity for me is very little about words. I mean, it is about words only to the extent that when words and deeds don't match up, that is when you need to start probing for authenticity. And it's not a lack of authenticity. Sometimes it's that people are holding discomfort in themselves that they don't know how to express, and it comes out in a gap. But I think, you know, mostly you know, authentic leadership is felt. It does come a bit back to the point about it's the being, not the doing. And although a lot of the time in the civil service we lead, you know, quite purposefully, you know, we think about what we need to do and then we do it, actually often the most powerful leadership is not when we're deciding to do something. It's the ability to create an atmosphere in which people feel something that makes them able to operate in a particular way. And that, I mean, I think that's the point in a sense where the things come back together, because I suppose what I'm taking out of this partly is there is an irresistible urge, to which I sign up completely, is to put order and frameworks, because that's how we do the work. But actually, the thing that really, you know, the only thing that makes it work ultimately is when we can also tap into the being and the feeling and, you know, and that kind of deep sense that is so strongly present in music.
I totally agree with that, and I identify very strongly with what you've just said. I mean, to produce a good, authentic interpretation of a piece of music, there has to be a joining up and an inner logic. But I would say that the role of intuition for a musician is a lifelong project of informing the intuition. So you start from some quite clear-cut notation. Musical notation can be very, very precise in latterly, not so precise in earlier music. It has evolved and become more and more complicated. So you could take a literal approach to that, or you could say this is a starting point for actually working out where the music is, and that comes from your life's work of informing your intuition, informing your own sense of musicianship. And I think as a leader in music, I certainly think being self-conscious about what you're doing is usually a disaster, certainly from my point of view. If I'm thinking, oh, am I doing this too fast, or am I being clear enough, or what am I doing here? If I'm thinking about what I'm doing too much, I know I'm not doing it very well, and it all starts going wrong. If I'm just thinking about where the music's going and what the trajectory of the music is, and my role in kind of just directing it there and letting people be part of that, that's when things, I feel, work. I may be completely wrong about that, but that's where I feel it is. So being kind of self-conscious about the doing and sort of not letting the intuition in is usually fatal from the musical point of view, in my experience.
Yep. Fantastic. We need to stop, but I'm conscious I haven't answered the question. I think the best answer I can give you is almost a continuation of this same conversation, that if we reduce everything down to a kind of utilitarian base, which can be the temptation because we need to be practical, then we are losing something, and the something that we're losing is the same thing we've been talking about kind of in the whole of this last section. It's the what is it that goes beyond all of these things and into a space that is really about kind of the deep personal, and that finds its expression in all sorts of different forms of beauty. So we're going to finish with a last piece from the choir. Just before that, I'm going to thank James very, very much for wonderful
pleasure.
Contributions. I'm also going to thank the Elysians for taking the trouble to come along and provide such fantastic music for us. The last piece that they're going to sing is Hubert Parry's My Soul, There Is a Country. Now, Sam chose this because Parry was passionate about his role both in composing public and ethical music, but also in nurturing the next generation through his leadership of the Royal College of Music and his extraordinarily generous personality. But it's also a particularly suitable choice for today's subject. So I first sang My Soul, There Is a Country when I was at university. When I told my parents, they said, oh, but that's the civil servants' anthem. Because it has a line in it about commanding the beauteous files. So it is, for me, a piece forever associated with the civil service, and definite proof, if such was needed, that bureaucracy can indeed be beautiful. I give you the Elysian Singers.